You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And on today's show, as we look ahead to Tuesday's primary election on the Illinois side of the river, we're going to take you back to another primary election some 30 years ago with historical significance. It's not a presidential primary, not a primary for the U.S. Senate, governor, or even Congress. Nope, it was a primary election for a seat in the Illinois General Assembly on the Republican side that attracted national attention and wound up impacting one of the closest and most controversial presidential elections in our nation's history about 10 years later. Are you a little bit curious here? I hope so, because I remember this race, and I'm really glad to have as my guest today Patrick Wohl, who wrote an outstanding book about this race. The book is called Down Ballot: How a Local Campaign Became a National Referendum on Abortion. And Patrick, congratulations. This is an outstanding book.
Well, Robin, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the kind words about the book.
Well, and again, I'm old enough to remember this, but take us back, our listeners who may not be aware, but take us back to the setting when and where this election took place and who the major players were.
Well, this all takes place in the early 1990s and also part of the late 80s, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But the two women here were eventually, at different points in time, longtime legislators in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. So Park Ridge and Des Plaines, kind of right near O'Hare Airport. And in 1990, when this takes place, Penny Poland was by then a longtime legislator in Illinois. She had been elected to that area at the age of 29, actually, in 1976. She was someone who I would say on the right, people might consider kind of a conservative rising star behind the scenes. And she'd been involved in all sorts of statewide and national issues that got her a lot of attention. So most notably, the Equal Rights Amendment fight in Illinois, which I think a lot of people don't realize just how much Illinois was the center of that whole debate at the time, and actually ended up being, as I talk about in the book, pretty much the place where the amendment ended up failing. So she played a principal role in fighting against that. And you would see during rallies and events and things around this time, three people on flyers posted across newspapers in the state. You'd see Phyllis Schlafly, the well-known activist who called Poland one of her dearest friends. You'd see the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who I'm sure most people will recognize, the televangelist. And you'd see Penny Poland also was one of the principal opponents of the ERA in that time. And Poland was also known because she was appointed to all sorts of presidential commissions by President Reagan, President George H.W. Bush. The most notable one was had to do with AIDS in the 80s, 1987. President Reagan put together a panel of 13 people. She was one of them, essentially tasked with trying to craft a solution to that crisis. And the reason was because she had introduced all sorts of legislation in the General Assembly in Springfield. Much of it was very controversial. A lot of it, she butt heads on with public health officials, but she got a lot of things passed. One of those, for example, was a marriage testing bill that was in effect for a little over a year. So anyone getting married in the state of Illinois had to be tested because of this bill she passed. A lot of people were getting married, didn't like it. So they would cross the border to Wisconsin or Iowa or Indiana. But out of all these issues, though, she was most notable as Penny Poland was most notable as a leader in the pro-life movement in Illinois. And that became essentially her driving cause. And I would say, politically speaking, even if this takes place in the 1990s, there's a lot of lessons you can draw. And I would say she sort of represents the, evangelical Republican, very socially conservative deeply religious that we talk about today. And her opponent was, in 1990, she was a paralegal. She hadn't been very politically involved. Her name was Rosemary Mulligan. And she decided to run against Penny Pollan after she introduced some abortion legislation. There was a Supreme Court decision in 1989 called Webster v. Reproductive Health Services. And essentially what the United States Supreme Court did was let states have more leeway in restricting abortion. So Penny Pollan moved on that newfound leeway, tried to copy the law that the United States Supreme Court had upheld and bring it to Illinois. And that really pushed Rosemary Mulligan to run. And again, in a Republican primary, notably, this is a Republican primary. And that's sort of a good setup of what these two, who these two women at, were at the time. But in politically speaking, I would say Rosemary Mulligan is sort of on the other side of the spectrum politically. She's more, I would say, a Chamber of Commerce type Republican, or maybe a sort of, you know, the suburban pro-choice woman who maybe used to vote Republican, but has sort of shifted in recent years, especially during the Trump era. So both women are not well known in, you know, the annals of political history, but I would say represent the thousands of legislators across the country who work on issues like these, but don't get a lot of attention.
This was an interesting time. Politically in Illinois, where population growth continued to go up north, but not necessarily in Chicago, but in the suburbs. I remember this. And these divides, these battles were taking place in both parties between people in the middle and people on the extreme, just like we got today. Not extreme, but more further conservative or progressive. I'm really curious, and I have to say this, that as somebody who teaches political science, I'll tell our listeners, this book is a great background or primer on running a state legislative race. You take time and go through what these candidates did. Some of this is similar, some of it a little different than now, but a lot of it is, I think, is still the same. But take us through. You've got these two candidates set up, ideologically different in the Republican primary. What did they do? What were some of the basics of the campaigns they did to try to get their message across to voters?
Well, the basics, you're right. Some things have changed. Some things have stayed the same. So, you know, I talk about in the book, all try to give people an understanding of what it's like to work on a political campaign. I think regardless of party, too, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, I think you'll appreciate those aspects of it. So, you know, I talk about gathering signatures in the winter to get on the ballot and you know, what a typical campaign office like is like, what it's like to encounter voters on these heated issues. You know, the kind of centerpiece issue of this campaign was abortion. So obviously you had very heated emotions on both sides of this. So when I interviewed people, they would talk about, you know, doors slammed in their face, which is not uncommon. People being, you know, denied communion in church because they were supporting one side or the other. All sorts of really heated atmosphere in this way. And I would say the importance of this race really is that it was viewed at the time as sort of a national proxy war on the issue of abortion. And the reason was because the Illinois primary, as it is still, is very, very early in March. And so this was essentially the first political test after the 1989 Webster decision that the pro-life and the pro-choice side had to kind of prove their point that their issue was their side was had the winning issue, or the winning stance rather. And so you had funding coming in from all sorts of national groups supporting both women. So Rosemary Mulligan notably had the support of Personal PAC, which is the well-known pro-choice group in Illinois that was actually just starting out at this time. This was kind of their first really race that they were involved in. You had all sorts of, you know, NARAL and other pro-choice groups supporting her. And then on the other side, on the pro-life side, Penny Pollan had kind of a, I would say, a Rolodex that people would envy, and had a lot of people following her at the time. She, as I mentioned, was an acquaintance, a friend of Phyllis Schlafly, who would do events or send letters for her. Obviously, I talked about the presidents that appointed her to commissions. Henry Hyde was also a supporter. For those who might not remember, he was a congressman in Illinois in that area, and whose district actually overlapped with hers. And that was important because while she was one of the principal pro-life voices in the General Assembly in Springfield, Henry Hyde was leading that movement, I would say, in Washington. And he's known today as the namesake of the Hyde Amendment, which prevents, you know, federal funds from being spent on abortion. So he came in and supported her. They would do events. The McCaskies, the owners of the Chicago Bears, were supporters as well, mostly because of her pro-life stances. They would do brunches for her and that sort of thing. And Richard DeVos, who people might recognize the DeVos name. They're well-known operatives. Betsy DeVos, obviously, was Donald Trump's Secretary of Education. And Richard DeVos was the head of Amway. He was an RNC committeeman. He was very involved in the national GOP. And he was essentially, I mean, one of the richest men in America, if not the world. And yet he was paying attention to, you know, this little race in the Northwest suburbs, came in to do a fundraiser because people really viewed it as that much of a test on the issue of abortion. And so I think that's one thing that makes this different than a lot of other legislative campaigns, too. Is there's all sorts of national figures that are involved in it. You know, I mentioned the AIDS piece, too, even aside from people supporting either campaigns. There's all sorts of side stories with national figures like Anthony Fauci, who was involved in the AIDS Commission. Hillary Clinton was a classmate of Penny Pollan. And I talk about that and their sort of relationship as high schoolers and former Goldwater girls. So all sorts of national figures that make appearances throughout this story.
This race got, as we've said, got national media attention as well. Not only was money pouring in, but it was featured on national news and newspapers.
Absolutely. You know, the day after the 92 campaign, excuse me, the 1990 campaign, you had, you know, Diane Sawyer and folks talking about this campaign and the importance of it. And especially in the Illinois press and the Chicago press, especially, was just wall-to-wall coverage of this. The Sun-Times at the time called it the hottest race in the state. ABC7 Chicago talked about it being a national litmus test on abortion, like I said. And even the Daily Herald, one of the daily papers in Chicago and the Northwest suburbs and the Western suburbs, the political reporter at the time said that this was unlike any campaign she covered in 30 years of her time as in journalism. So it was people were certainly paying attention to the outcome here.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Patrick Wohl, W-O-H-L. He's written a very interesting book called Down Ballot, How a Local Campaign Became a National Referendum on Abortion. Very readable. If you're not a political junkie like me, you'll still like this book. There's a lot of elements, I think, on it that will appeal to people. The writing style is good. It's very approachable, understandable, and it's a great primer on political campaigns and takes you back to a time maybe a little different, but still the same in some ways in our state and national political history. All right, let's cut to the chase. We got these two candidates on opposing sides of this issue. What happened? Who won? And how did the process go of deciding the winner?
Well, Robin, that's a tough question. And not because I'm cagey or dodging, but because it was unclear on election night and in the hours to come. So on March 20th, 1990, which was primary night in Illinois, Rosemary Mulligan, the pro-choice candidate, had appeared to be the winner by 31 votes. And there was all sorts of excitement over that. The next day, lots of coverage of it, like I mentioned. But they quickly realized that there had been an error in counting at one of the polling places. It's the sort of casual error that, you know, does happen. Sometimes it's rectified. Or it doesn't matter because, you know, it's usually not this close of an election. So they fixed that and the outcome was ended up being much closer. So they knew there was a recount in order. And so both sides lawyered up. They found attorneys to work on their cases. They ended up having to spend time in a warehouse in Cook County, looking at ballots, figuring out which they would contest, and use essentially as the evidence in the trial, which ballots they would dispute. And the main dispute here centered on a phrase that I think a lot of your, most of your listeners, if not all, will recognize, and that is over the issue of dimpled chads. And so when they set aside all their ballots, they would bring it before a circuit county judge, Cook County circuit judge and begin that process. And they were arguing over which to count, and they would argue over, you know, if the light peered through a hole, should that matter? If it's just a small dimple or a very large one, how do we judge how these count? And they went through this process, and Mulligan lost some votes, still was ahead by just a few votes. And eventually they went back and forth through this process. And as they were counting and reached the last ballot in this process, Judge Francis Barth, the judge at the time, was not keeping track, but some of the attorneys were. Bert Olson, who's a still well-known election attorney in the state of Illinois, said to the judge as he counted the last ballot, "Judge, I believe we have a tie." And it was tied 7,387 to 7,387. So what do you do if it's tied? You know, this is a very complicated process they'd just gone through. You'd had hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on this campaign, which doesn't seem like a lot of money, but was at that time. You had all this evidence collected, the lawyers, the legal fees. So what do you do in the event of a recount? Well, Illinois law says, in this case, you flip a coin. So they flipped a coin in July of 1990, and Rosemary Mulligan, the pro-choice candidate, called tails, and she won. It was another kind of flashpoint in this. Cameras all over, reporters paying attention, kind of a novelty to see this. But at the end of the day, it was really just a formality, and it determined who would appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. So Penny Pollin appealed, and essentially what the Illinois Supreme Court did is send it back to the judge and say, you have to make some decisions about which to count and which to count, which not to count, because he really didn't originally want to get in the game of, you know, calling balls and strikes. And they said, nope, that's what you got to do. So they went through this process all over again, folded up the ballots, sent it up to back to the Illinois Supreme Court, which declared Penny Pollin the winner of this election by just 6 votes.
And again, I guess I remembered this election, but I did not remember the dimpled chad controversy. And you can tell us briefly how, you know, a lot of our listeners will remember the role this played in Bush versus Gore, but some of the same attorneys were involved on opposite side in one case, at least.
They absolutely were. And it's a kind of fun point about how some of these issues aren't necessarily political in that sense, in a recount at least. And so Bert Odelson, who I mentioned, represented Rosemary Mulligan, the pro-choice, more sort of moderate candidate. And he ended up working, helping with the Bush team in Florida. And his counterpart, Mike Lavelle, who was also a very well-known election attorney and a mentor of Bert Olson, he represented Penny Pollin, the conservative candidate, and then ended up helping the Gore team in 2000. So they kind of flipped there. And I think people will appreciate that. But this became a huge flashpoint in Florida too in 2000, because essentially, just briefly, I'll say, when they were looking both sides for cases to support their notion that for the Gore team, they should count dimple chads, for the Bush team, they shouldn't. There aren't a lot of cases that dealt with this issue. And so they looked to the Pollin v. Mulligan case from the Illinois Supreme Court. And it became kind of a funny side story because, you know, in 2000, you couldn't just look up a case on LexisNexis or Google it or whatever and figure out what it held. You had to actually go to a warehouse and find the physical files. And, you know, unless you had something, it was more difficult process. So there was an article in the Chicago Tribune that talked about this Pollin v. Mulligan case and said, hey, you count dimple chads. That's what the court said in Illinois. And so the Gore team called up Mike Lavelle, the former Poland attorney, said, "Hey, can you attest to this in an affidavit?" He said, "Sure." And signed one, sent it off to them. And the Gore team used this to argue before canvassing boards in Florida that they should count dimple chats. But the problem was that that wasn't what the court held. It said, "Is to the extent a voter's intent can be determined, then you can count votes," which is a very different thing. So he got all sorts of accusations thrown at against him. The legal team for Gore didn't necessarily stick, but it did become important because cases like Poland were eventually the reason that the United States Supreme Court cited for an equal protection violation, saying because there are all these different standards in counties, some are counting dimple chads, some are not, based on cases like Poland v. Mulligan, that the count has to stop. There's a violation, and essentially delivered the victory to then Governor Bush. So the next time, Robin, someone tells you local politics is uninteresting or inconsequential, just point them to that race.
That's right. Well, what's interesting is the story on Penny Pullen and Middlesbrough Mulligan isn't over yet. What happens next up in the Chicago suburbs?
Well, in following this race, Rosemary Mulligan really decides she's just going to keep running. And so she never really stops the campaign, continues to hold events and fundraisers. They reach eventually closer to the 1992 election. And the state of Illinois is undergoing the redistricting process. And for the first time in a while, and the last time this has happened, Republicans controlled the process in the state of Illinois. It had to do with Governor Edgar being elected. It was thrown to a commission. The commission tied. Then eventually he appointed someone that broke the tie, and this delivered it to delivered the power to draw maps to Republicans. So they carved up, as you kind of alluded to, Robin, the suburbs to try to gain some political power there. And so while Rosemary Mulligan was running, Penny Pullen was in the General Assembly still, obviously going to run again. And sure enough, when the maps were released, Rosemary Mulligan's house was cut out of the district just by a few blocks, which obviously would upset anyone and certainly did upset her and her team. But I don't think she gave it much thought, because as she eventually decided pretty quickly that she was going to run again, no matter what, and sell her house if she won. So she continued running, and on St. Patrick's Day, 1992, March 17th, 1992, she ended up winning and beating Penny Pullen in that rematch election, which was also followed very, very closely, both in the Illinois and national press, and became an important victory for that side. And then Rosemary Mulligan obviously went on to be a longtime legislator in that district until 2013.
And abortion played a big role there, because there was another Supreme Court case. I mean, your book does a great job, too, of following the abortion issue as it goes from Roe v. Wade back in 72. Two consequential decisions that ironically came right on the eve of these primaries.
Absolutely. And the decision you're alluding to is the Casey decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which it changed a lot. A lot of people think, especially when the Dobbs decision came down in June of 2022. Yeah, June of 2022. A lot of people were sort of, talking about the overturning of Roe, which it did do, obviously. But arguably the more important precedent in terms of the law on abortion was this Casey decision, which essentially upheld Roe, the kind of core of Roe, saying that there is a right to privacy under the 14th Amendment that includes a woman's right whether or not to have an abortion. But it added this sort of what was the standard for a long time on the law surrounding abortion about undue burden. And that was a term that it's appeared other places, but was put into the law essentially by Sandra Day O'Connor. And so She sort of cobbled together decisions on that issue and tried to keep Roe largely intact while she was on the bench. And obviously that changed all in 2022.
We have just like 2 minutes left. I want to end up my final question. Again, fascinating book, but you go throughout this at the beginning and the end about the importance of local elections. And as a former city councilman in a town of 10,000, I agree. I mean, make the picture to our listeners why these elections are so important, and in some cases more important than perhaps even, you know, your top level state offices and federal offices.
Well, it's a great point, and that is really my only message in this book. I'll say is that people should be more involved in local politics. 80% of Americans can't name a single state legislator of theirs, which is really astounding. And even more astounding, especially for your listeners to hear, who I know are more engaged than most people, 1 in 3 people can't even name their own governor. So there is a real attention deficit when it comes to local politics. But, you know, there's 23 times as many bills passed in Congress, passed in state legislatures each year than in Congress. And I would argue your average member of a state legislature in Iowa or in Illinois who controls a committee or has some sort of influence is more influential on your daily life than, you know, your run-of-the-mill member of Congress who gets all this attention because they're in federal office. But the issues that impact people most are really decided in state capitals, not in Washington. And so that's my message of this book is that, you know, there's a hero for everyone in this story. If you're pro-choice, you'll appreciate Rosemary Mulligan. If you're pro-life, you'll appreciate Penny Pullen. And at the end of the day, on all of the issues that we're talking about today, on each of these issues, there's a Rosemary Mulligan and there's a Penny Pullen, and they're watching closely. The only question is who's watching them.
The final point I'll add is this was a time for our listeners when, believe it or not, there were pro-choice Republicans and pro-life Democrats. Positions were more diverse in both parties, not so much anymore. Patrick Walsman is my guest today. He's the author of Down Ballot, How a Local Campaign Became a National Referendum on Abortion. Great book. I recommend it. And I think our listeners will find it very interesting. So go out and get a copy. Patrick, thank you again for your time today.
Robin, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.